From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Bill Nygut. Today, Chuck Schumer walked into a firestorm when he called Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu an obstacle to peace and condemned the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
It has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th.
But Georgia Senators John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock have both spoken out on the toll the war is taking on civilians.
I'm Tia Mitchell in Washington. As the Georgia legislative session nears an end, Republicans have unveiled a flurry of new election bills suggesting they remain concerned that the 2020 election was rigged. AJC election expert Mark Nisi will join us with a look at what Republicans are proposing.
Governor Kemp has been a big supporter of Texas Governor Greg Abbott's effort to seize control of illegal immigration. But yesterday, rapid-fire court rulings have led to confusion over Abbott's ability to move forward to take control from the feds. We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Welcome to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Politically Georgia. I'm Bill Nygut, along with Tia Mitchell in Washington, who once again is on government shutdown watch. We'll talk about it a little bit later in the show, but this seems to be a never-ending story, Tia.
Yeah, I mean, yes, and at this point, we'll talk about it later, but it looks like shutdown averted, so we're not quite on shutdown watch, but it has definitely been a repeating narrative.
Okay, well, we will talk a bit about that, especially how members of the Georgia delegation are once again feeling about having to deal with government spending. But we're going to start today with a story that is commanding, of course, international headlines, as well as headlines across the country and right here in Georgia. The toll that Israel's war against Hamas is now taking on Palestinian civilians in Gaza in many ways has begun to overshadow the horrific attacks that Hamas launched against innocent Israelis back in October of last year. But the destruction of so much of the Gaza Strip has President Biden, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at loggerheads. Biden wants the prime minister to allow far more aid into the country. He would like to see the prime minister call for a ceasefire or agree to a ceasefire. Netanyahu has not been terribly receptive. And in the meantime, both Georgia U.S. Senators John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock have called for a smoother flow of aid to the Palestinians as well. So we're going to talk about that from both a historical and a political perspective. And to do that, we've invited Eli Sperling, who is a University of Georgia Israel Institute teaching fellow. And also, Eli, you're the author of an upcoming book.
Yes.
Singing the Land, Hebrew Music and Early Zionism in America. First of all, thank you for being here. Tell us a little bit about the book. When does it come out, and what exactly is it?
So the book was released on March 3rd. Oh. So it's been in the world for a couple weeks now. And it is an analysis of how Zionism evolved in the United States and transitioned from a relatively polemical movement, in fact, in the Jewish community in America at the turn of the 20th century, and moved towards becoming a central mainstream component of American Jewish life and identity. And I do this through analyzing a series of American Zionist song publications that I found in archives in Israel.
Well, you know, interesting, of course, and you know this, it's a perfect moment for this, because right now there are many questions being raised about whether Jewish identity does necessarily have to be attached to Israel or not. And we'll explore a little bit about that as we begin. Tia, I'm just going to ask a couple quick questions of Eli about key moments in the history of the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians. And I want to start, Eli, with the 1993 Oslo Accords, which paved the way for an actual two-state solution. Tell us a little bit about what those Oslo Accords did and where they went wrong.
So I'll start actually a little bit before, because this really starts in the 1990s with the Madrid Conference that was organized by President Bush and came out of the first Iraq War. And as Bush realizes that he may not get a second term, and we have a new prime minister in Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, a decorated general and popular politician on the left coming into power, when Clinton is elected, he vows to continue what was started in Madrid and forges a very close relationship with Prime Minister Rabin. And this leads to a groundbreaking series of negotiations and agreements known as the Oslo Accords. 1993, of course, being the first. This was signed on the White House lawn and is known as the Declaration of Principles. And this allowed for a mutual recognition whereby Prime Minister Rabin acknowledged and gave his hand, so to speak, to the PLO and Yasser Arafat, who in turn replied recognizing the state of Israel. And then the Palestinian Authority is formed in 1994. This is the first time we had a formal organized government structure within the Palestinians, including an armed police force. And in 1995, in what is known as Oslo II, we have a map established with three spheres of influence in the West Bank, fully controlled by Israel, a joint control, and then fully controlled by the Palestinians. And in this map, it was determined that by 2000, Israel would pull back all of its administration, settlers, military infrastructure, and personnel, returning control of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to the Palestinian Authority.
But of course, over those years, in fact, Israelis expanded settlements in the West Bank, we know that, but also in Gaza. I think there are many people who may not realize that the Gaza Strip at one point had a great many Israeli settlers building homes there. And in 2005, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, in what at the time was an enormously controversial decision, called for all of those Israelis in the Gaza Strip to be removed from the territory. And in fact, some of the most compelling video I can recall as a Jew seeing back then was Israeli forces, IDF troops, going into Israel and bulldozing Jewish homes. But Ariel Sharon believed that there was never going to be a peace as long as Gaza was occupied by the Israelis, correct?
Correct. And we see Oslo process failing as a result of Yitzhak Rabin being assassinated and Netanyahu winning his first term, expanding settlements and stonewalling the process. And by the time we get to 2005, with the conclusion of the Second Intifada, then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon felt that Gaza was a liability and even took great domestic political heat in dismantling 21 settlements there. And beyond the bulldozing of the settlements, the imagery of police and IDF soldiers forcibly removing settlers from the Gaza Strip was a deep rift and even a reckoning within Israeli society between the left and the right.
Yeah,
once that finished in the summer, there were no longer Israeli settlers, IDF presence, or any Israeli administration controlling the interior.
And Tia, let's continue this a little bit. As a result of all of that, it gave Hamas the opportunity to form a government. So there were elections in the in Gaza. Yes, Hamas won the elections, in largely because they killed many of the opponents who were facing them. So Hamas is not just a military force, it's a government authority. And when the Israelis cleared out, Eli, just a quick final thing, and then I want to get Tia in to talk about the politics. So Hamas has a control over Gaza that goes beyond what a lot of people think of as just being they're being fighters against Israel.
Yes, and in 2007, 2 years after that withdrawal, Hamas takes full control of the Gaza Strip and is the governing body within the Strip. They handle administration, schools, health issues, and beyond their military wing, they are the government that operates within the Gaza Strip.
So, Tia, let's bring it up to the present. You jump in right now, please.
Yeah, thank you for joining us, Eli. And I do, you know, I guess my first question I want to ask you is about, particularly on the right, when you see Democrats saying, I want to support Israel in its right to defend itself against an attack, and Democrats are also saying, but we think Israel's going too far. There's a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. It's a problem. Mm-hmm. But on the right, it's almost like they're saying, no, well, you can't have it both ways. Either you defend Israel, full stop, or you're sympathetic to a terrorist organization. Can you explain, do you agree that it has to be one or the other? Or if you don't agree, how can you explain the nuance of saying, I do support Israel, but I also think Gaza has a humanitarian crisis and it's Israel needs to do better.
Yeah, so I'll start by saying I think it is a dangerous binary. And the situation is so much more nuanced than either this right-wing notion that if you don't support all of Israel's actions, you are in support of Hamas, or conversations on the far left about not continuing to partner with Israel in the same capacities as a result. And I would say that, first of all, many Israelis agree that this war needs to come to a conclusion and that the humanitarian crisis is grave, in fact. I mean, it's astounding what's going on. And I think it is important for Americans to realize how much more nuanced it is than just this binary, and realizing too that so many Israelis are not in any sort of approval of the government, that there are many in Israel that agree with the center-left position. And I think that it's much more about framing this issue within domestic American politics rather than thinking about the best ways to move forward in pushing the Netanyahu government towards a conclusion of this conflict.
You know, Eli, Senator Chuck Schumer, of course, has gotten an enormous amount of attention and has been caught in a raging controversy because he called for new elections. He knows, he said, of course, that Netanyahu is an obstacle to peace. Netanyahu is in the hold right now of the far right coalition that he's built, which would like to wipe Gaza clean of Palestinians in many people's minds. But although Schumer is now, as a Jew himself, caught in controversy over this, we should point out that within 6 weeks after Israel launched its war against Hamas, our own John Ossoff, the first Jewish senator from Georgia, took to the Senate floor and he became one of the very first people to speak out about what was happening to Palestinians in Gaza. Let's listen to just a brief moment of what he said.
The extent of civilian death and suffering in Gaza is unnecessary. It is a moral failure, and it should be unacceptable to the United States.
Eli, it took great courage, I think, for an Ossoff, at a time when Jews in Georgia were not sure where they wanted to land, to make that statement.
So I think, first of all, it's important to note that this was a very novel statement out of the Senate at this point, and Ossoff was the first amongst his colleagues to come out and make such a statement. But I think this also represents Ossoff being a younger senator, representing a younger and more liberal voice, particularly on this issue amongst American voters. And I think that he felt maybe even more responsible for coming out and making a statement as a result of being a Jewish progressive in the Senate. And so I think it's the case that while there was frustration from members of the Atlanta and broader Georgia Jewish community, this was an opportunity for Ossoff to position himself in this conversation and try and use his position to maybe force some change on the Israeli government side.
Tia?
I want to ask about, you know, we were asking about the binary from the right, and you mentioned there is some also from the left. So I want to dig into that a little bit more, because on the left, there's a lot of people you'll hear, especially younger voters, say, we've got to abandon this longstanding commitment to Israel. And, you know, you'll hear especially elected officials, people who have a little bit more political insight, say, we can't abandon our ally. But you'll hear again from the further left, they're saying, why is Israel someone that we feel the need to hold up, even when there are grave concerns about how they're treating the people, the Palestinian people, particularly in Gaza? Can you explain that? And if that, do you believe that's also a false binary? Or do you think it is time for maybe America to reevaluate its allyship with Israel?
So I think at its core, the allyship is just a central feature of America's foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East. Israel is a part of American CENTCOM. There are countless partnerships on a variety of non-military related issues. And for many elected officials, they see the importance of these partnerships in upholding U.S. foreign policy, but also have concerns about Israel's policies towards the Palestinians, towards the peace process. And I think this is why we start to see figures like Ossoff speak out and Schumer particularly attacking the Netanyahu government. And I think for me, what's important to remember in Israel is that only 15% of Israelis see Netanyahu as being viable after the war. And I think continuing partnerships and working with Israel from the inside and through these official channels can help give a basis for the left to finally put up a prime minister. And we haven't seen a left of center government in Israel in 25 years. And in this sense, I think right now it is important to think about how we can work with Israel to help Israelis see a democratic process that would push out Netanyahu, which we know most want to do. And I think there is a lot of optimism to be seen for what an Israeli government without Netanyahu at its core could do in terms of pursuing new policies. I think that discussing cutting Israel off, so to speak, is dangerous, because I think that that would only give more power to the far right at this moment in pursuing policies that are not aligned with U.S. interests.
Eli, you talk about we haven't seen a center-left government in Israel for 25 years. I remember very clearly what it was like. I was sent to Israel following the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, who was certainly pushing for two-state solution. And that really was the beginning of the end of a government that was committed to finding a way to live peaceably with their Palestinian neighbors, while at the same time assuring the security of the Israeli people, yes?
Yes. And we have to remember that in 2000, in the summer, Ehud Barak, elected to the prime minister's seat after Netanyahu's first term, went to Camp David with President Clinton and Yasser Arafat and offered another landmark proposal for a two-state solution, which, of course, fell apart, Arafat walked away, and that brought about the Second Intifada, which is when we see Israeli voters stick to the right. And with a little bit of movement towards the center in the mid-2000s, we just have not seen a left-wing government even really seem possible. And so I think that giving the opportunity for the center-left that is gaining a great deal of electoral support right now to form a government, I think that there is optimism to be seen in a peace process moving forward with that.
Tia, meanwhile, you talked about the right and how they're approaching all of this. Donald Trump, as you know, has made some extraordinary statements recently about the Jewish a community in the United States. Let's just listen to something he said on Sebastian Gorka's podcast, which has gotten a lot of attention, but let's play it right now.
Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves because Israel will be destroyed.
Yeah,
I think that goes back to what we were saying about how on the right, there's this kind of messaging that any criticism perceived, any real or perceived criticism of Israel is kind of like anti-American or goes against Jewish ideals. And I think to me, it brings it back to Eli, what you were talking about Zionism and whether there's this discussion about whether Jewish identity today has to be so tied to Israeli statehood. Can you talk a little bit about that evolution? And do you think, especially young Jewish people, do they still, are they, I know, I'm assuming they're still encouraged to have that affinity and those ties to Israel, but is it still happening?
It is still happening. Although we do see shifts in this younger generation of Jewish Americans and their attitudes towards Israel, I think that there's still a strong sense of connection to Israel as the second largest Jewish community in the world. I think that there's a connection to the cultural diversity of Jews in Israel, as for many Americans, they look amongst themselves who are pretty demographically similar, yet go to Israel and meet Iraqi Jews, Moroccan Jews, Syrian Jews, Yemenite Jews, and connect to a very different understanding of diversity within the Jewish community, but at the same time, find a great deal of problems with Israel's government's policies towards the Palestinians. And I think that this is also indicative of the fact that Israel's governments have been so conservative for the past 25 years and have certainly impacted American Jews and even more so young American Jews' views towards Israel and its government, particularly considering that Jews are historically 70 to 80% Democrats. And I don't think Trump with these types of statements is going to necessarily sway already left of center American Jews. And I think it's fear mongering. But for Jews on the left, I think that there is a clear sense that the binary Trump is trying to create is not something they identify with. But they are searching for an outlet in American politics to feel that they can still maintain that personal connection with Israel, yet have a voice for airing legitimate grievance towards its government.
Eli, I've got time for one last question, and it's a complicated answer. So I'm going to say, what's the simplest way we could talk about it? The question becomes the post-war future of the Gaza Strip. And Tom Friedman, in his new column in the New York Times, Friedman knows the Middle East better than almost any other journalist, I think, in the world. And Friedman thinks that the future ought to be that Arab states create partnerships in the Gaza Strip to control the territory and look to a progressive future. He sees the potential for that to be much like Dubai today, but on the far right in Israel. You've got many saying, no, 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 we should get the Palestinians out of Gaza. We should retake that territory. If very quickly, give us a thumbnail sketch of that.
So what's important to remember here is the evolution of the Abraham Accords. We had the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan sign peace agreements with Israel under Likud leadership, by the way, in 2020. And we've already had offers from the United Arab Emirates to provide aid, to even provide 2 desalination plants for Gazans to help create more robust infrastructure moving forward. We know the Saudis have expressed a great deal of interest in providing financial funds and political support. And I think that there is great interest amongst more Western-aligned Sunni states, particularly those in the Gulf, to help rebuild Gaza and maybe even to come in and help provide administrative support. Now, is it the smartest idea or something we can bank on that these autocratic partners in the region will truly create a more progressive Gaza? That's hard to say, but we know the will is there to certainly provide support for its rebuilding.
Eli Sperling, we've got to take a break, but I think Tia and I are both so grateful for the insights you brought to us today. So we should keep you on hand. You should come back at some point.
I will be pleased to return. Thank you so much for having me.
Let me once again give you a plug. Your book is Singing the Land, Hebrew Music and Early Zionism in America. Eli, thank you so much for being with us. Let's get to a break right now. But you know what? When we come back, we're going to talk to our expert when it comes to election matters, Mark Nisi, because in the final days of the legislature, all of a sudden there are a lot of election bills springing up that seem to be hatched by right-wing Republicans who think the 2020 election was rigged and can't get past it. This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from me and the AJC politics team. Just go to AJC.com/newsletters and sign up today. That's AJC.com/newsletters. Tia, we're going to bring in Mark Nisi, our colleague, who keeps us on top of all the election issues going on, both in the legislature, at the state election board, and all the other areas that involve Georgia elections. And Tia, what's fascinating is, and I think, Mark, you'll agree with this, we thought maybe we were going to get through a session without any major election reform, so-called reform measures, but they all of a sudden have started popping up. And Tia, they seem to once again be inspired by this fear that the 2020 election was rigged. Tia?
Yeah. And Mark, of course, we always appreciate you joining us because we know how busy the session time can be. But it seems to me, my question for you, Mark, it seems to me that it's not as kind of the sky is falling very kind of transformative changes the way the General Assembly kind of did immediately after the election in that 2021 session, in the 2022 session. But so it's not, they don't seem to be as impactful, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I still wonder, why are they tweaking the election system at all?
Well, you're right. So many of these bills, I count 9 bills that are alive and moving through the General Assembly in its final days. And, you know, unlike the law that passed after the 2020 election, most of these bills don't have to do with the voting process, right? It's not changing how you can vote absentee, and it's not changing early voting hours, and it's not designating whether the state can take over a county's election board. You know, this year we have so many things that have been bubbling up maybe since 2020, but aren't necessarily life-changing on the voter experience. So we're talking about items dealing with increasing election security by putting watermarks on ballots, putting ballot images online so skeptics can see for themselves that the count was legitimate. We're talking about maybe reducing or eliminating computer codes on ballots, which has been a concern from people who say those aren't transparent and you can't know how people voted, and on, right? So there are many bills. Many of them do originate from a place of skepticism or suspicion around elections, but they are not fundamental changes to our elections process. They're more tinkering in many, many ways.
Yeah, but some of them are, isn't it fair to say that some of the things that have been introduced are, in fact, measures that could have an impact on voter turnout? Whatever happened to, I think it's HB 976, for example, which was the bill that would have eliminated motor voter automatic voting, which automatic voter registration, which, of course, was something Governor Kemp put in place when he was Secretary of State and was responsible for vastly expanding the number of people in the state eligible to vote. There's that measure. You've also reported on 1370, HB 1370, which would reduce the number of voting machines in precincts around the state. It feels like those are bills that are looking for a reason to be enacted.
Well, there's always a reason, right? And the reason often is that the local Republican constituents ask their legislators to pursue these issues. And sometimes it's election officials asking for these things, like fewer voting machines on election day. The primary force behind that is election directors who think they have enough voting machines, and it's just unnecessary hassle and causes clutter to have more voting machines than they need in an era when we don't really have lines on election day. If there are lines, it's usually during early voting, especially on those last few days before a general election. And then you mentioned, yes, automatic voter registration. That idea does not appear to be moving forward. All the bill numbers kind of get mixed up as language gets inserted and removed and amended and substituted from bill to bill. But originally, the automatic registration bill, that was SB 221. Now, the bill you mentioned, HB 976, that deals with voter challenges, clarifying and strengthening the voter challenge law, as well as all these ballot security bureaucracy ideas like putting seals and paperwork and checks anytime anybody moves or touches a ballot. Also allowing public ballot inspections potentially, that hasn't been voted on in that bill yet, but it could be tomorrow, to allow make paper ballots public records under the Open Records Act. That's under consideration again. That hasn't been necessarily, they're contemplating adding that to that bill as well.
Mark, one provision of HB 976 is that it would still allow for the mass challenges to voter registration that's already in law, but it would create a buffer so those mass challenges could not happen within 45 days of an election. Can you talk about the practical application? To me, that would seem to be something that's a nod to the fact that perhaps some of those changes created undue stress on local election officials when all these ballots were challenged, and most of those challenges turned out not to be valid.
Right. So this bill gives and takes, right? It enhances the voter challenge law by specifying when challenges should be upheld, but it also contains limitations that could prevent wrongful challenges against voters and hinder their ability to vote in an election. Like you mentioned, a challenge wouldn't be heard if it's filed against a voter's eligibility within 45 days of an election. It would be considered after the election. So this bill, you know, again, it does solidify the place of voter challenges, where any resident can challenge the eligibility of any of their neighbors within their own county, and an unlimited number of them, but it constrains them in a way that says, don't do it during this time, and you have to use the following reasons, usually if somebody died or if they have proof that somebody registered to vote in another state. Or an interesting factor in this bill is taking into account whether they have a homestead exemption. If you have a homestead exemption in another state, you could be considered to have moved from Georgia and no longer eligible to vote in Georgia, which is kind of interesting.
Isn't that essentially what happened to Lucy McBath in her first run for Congress? I don't know that it was based on a homestead.
It was her husband's.
Well, that's what I was going to say. But there were Republicans who tried to use that to challenge her in that first election.
I remember that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, I think my understanding, and Tia, you probably know best on Representative McBath's residency, but my recollection is that she is and was a Georgia resident, and members of Congress don't have to live in their districts. So that's how that issue was resolved. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the Lucy McBath thing is a little bit different because her and her husband kind of live separately at times. So he does keep a residence in Tennessee. She, of course, keeps her residence in Georgia. And I know, you know, some people weren't buying that, but that's how McBath explained how her and her husband kind of live separately, but also together.
I apologize for trying to bring that in the mix. But Mark, okay, walk me back from the ledge, Mark.
There's another example, too. Remember Herschel Walker and his wife. There was questions about their residency as well. And if I recall correctly, I believe the home they lived in together in Texas, I believe they had, and I'd have to double check, but I believe they had a homestead exemption. Yeah. In Texas on that home, you know, ultimately they were ruled to, Herschel Walker was determined to be a Georgia resident when he was running for U.S. Senate. But, you know, they did have another home in another state that could, if this bill passes in a similar form, be used as a factor when election officials determine whether you are really a Georgia resident.
So, Mark, you and Tia have both sort of walked me back from the ledge in terms of my, you know, bleak view that these bills are once again Republican efforts to conjure up the notion of a 2020 election fraud that went on. And you've made it clear these are more minor than that. So I want to turn to one bill that I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on, Mark. You've mentioned it already. The bill that would remove the code from the paper ballot that we get and then feed into the voting machine. Every time on this show that we talk about, and I'm sure you've gotten this too, we talk about voting by machine, Gabe Sterling sends a quick text or email saying, these are just ballot marking machines. It is paper balloting. Stop confusing the issue. But when I feed that ballot into the machine, I don't know what that code is doing. Is it somewhat reasonable to ask that perhaps there should be a more transparent way to see how our votes are counting?
Right. That's the question. I mean, certainly it is a paper ballot produced by a ballot marking device. The ballot marking device just makes the paper ballot, and that paper ballot includes text of your choices and a QR code that encodes your choices. And when you insert the ballot into the scanner, it's the QR code that is scanned and counted. And it is true that you as a voter have no way of knowing whether that code includes the choices that are printed on your ballot. And that's why we have audits, and that's why we have, if necessary, recounts. You know, the audits do compare the code. Well, not exactly. The audits count the text and then see if it's very similar to the code. And it always has been in past audits. So that bill is up in committee at 3 p.m. this afternoon on Wednesday. We will see if it moves forward. There is broad agreement that it's very unlikely to happen this year, but maybe in the future, and maybe at significant cost to taxpayers. They estimate it would cost probably at least $20 million to create, buy new printers, upgrade software, and have a whole new type of ballot where the text could be read instead of the QR code. And the question is it worth it, right? Sure, it might be more transparent. Is this something that voters need and want? Possibly.
I just want to, as I say every time, want to point out it was Republicans who decided we didn't need paper ballots back when they bought the new machines not that long ago. But
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, these are paper ballots. They're just not hand-marked paper ballots. Right.
But, Republicans did not want the hand-marked paper ballots when bought new machines.
Absolutely. This is the voting system that the majority, which is held by the Republican Party, agreed to buy when they passed HB 316 in 2019.
Yes.
This electronic ballot marking system that prints out a paper ballot with a QR code. This is the system that we as a state bought for well over $100 million.
So And I just want to follow up, Mark, because you just mentioned some of this stuff is not, may not pass. What do you think may pass, and what do you think is just kind of messaging but might not make it the length?
I mean, really, at this point, all of these things are alive. I don't think revoking automatic voter registration will go forward, but, you know, getting rid of QR codes for 2025 or 2026, I could see that. Increasing voter challenges, or supporting voter challenges is a better way to say it. I could see that moving forward. Putting watermarks on ballots, more audits, putting ballots online, those things have cleared multiple committees already in both the House and the Senate. So I think that's likely to advance. Banning deep fake artificial intelligence campaign ads that could deceive voters, that has broad support, despite some opposition from members of the Freedom Caucus and the Republican Party. It has broad support among both mainstream Republicans and Democrats. So that's very likely to pass. So I think a lot of these things will move forward. It is so many items that they are considering. None of them are dramatic, but it is broad, right? We're talking about many, many changes to election administration in Georgia.
And Mark Nisi, you are keeping on top of all of those so that we don't have to do it in quite the depth that you do. I know this is a very busy time for you. So, Mark, we're really grateful that you could spend some time with us on Politically Georgia today. Thanks so much for being here.
Great. Always happy to come.
All right, Tia, let's get to our final break of the show. And when we come back, we've got a lot more to talk about right here on Politically Georgia.
Hip-hop is a product of Black people. It's a product of Black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents...
Hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny...
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We've got a great offer for Politically Georgia listeners. For a limited time, you can subscribe and get digital access to the AJC for $1.99 per week for life. That's right, for life. You can subscribe right now by going to ajc.com/start. That's ajc.com/start. It's a great deal for a greater Atlanta. And by the way, this is for new subscribers only. A Washington correspondent for the AJC, Tia Mitchell. It's government shutdown time again in D.C., but as you said at the top of the show, looks like the House has got its ducks in a row, and there's not going to be a shutdown. And some of the departments involved in this are pretty significant. I think Homeland Security, for one, but also the IRS. This is not the time you want to shut down the IRS.
Yeah, so these remaining agencies that need to be funded by the time their money runs out at the end of the day on Friday, they represent 70% of the federal government. It's things even like the Department of Defense. So there's a lot of important agencies that need their money. Or again, there's a partial shutdown deadline on Friday. Now, all of the leaders, all of the people who are in charge, both the House and the Senate, have said, we have reached an agreement. We're going to get this done. That's why I've turned my countdown to shutdown clock off. I think that now it's looking like it won't get done by Friday, particularly because the House needs to vote, and then the Senate needs to vote. And for the Senate to be able to vote quickly, you need unanimous consent. But as long as they get it done, you know, relatively quickly over the weekend or even Monday or Tuesday, even though technically the shutdown will be in place, you know, agencies can kind of stretch their money and make it work if it doesn't last too long. So that's what we're looking at right now. Now, that's all. The caveat is we still don't have the actual bill yet. We have an agreement verbally, but we don't have any bills. So the bill is supposed to be a minibus, putting all these bills together into one package. That's when lawmakers will feel more confident saying, I'm definitely voting yes, or I'm definitely voting no.
Tia, One of the interesting aspects for me to all of this is the story of Speaker Mike Johnson. We know that in the past, Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Andrew Clyde, that, well, Marjorie Taylor Greene did not want Kevin McCarthy to be voted out as Speaker, so I take that back. But we do know there are far-right Republicans who always want to throw the Speaker out of office when they don't get what they want out of these government spending measures. Is Mike Johnson just a masterful negotiator, or is he the recipient of good luck because Republicans are just plain tired of voting out speakers?
It's definitely B. And I think we should note that, yes, people like Andrew Clyde, he was part of the group that opposed McCarthy at the beginning. He, you know, went through all those, what, almost a dozen rounds of voting before McCarthy became Speaker. And they got a lot of concessions from McCarthy to earn their vote so that McCarthy could become Speaker. But once that happened, Andrew Clyde was not among the roughly half dozen Republicans who led to McCarthy's ouster in September. He wasn't a part of that. And so, but there were a half dozen Republicans who led that rebellion. We know there's been a lot of chaos in the House Republican Conference kind of ever since, but there is not an appetite to go through that again. And so I think Speaker Johnson is benefiting from that. I think he's also benefiting from people. It wasn't just political differences with Kevin McCarthy. Fellow Republicans did not trust him. They mm-hmm. did not feel that he had been upfront with them. And so you're hearing people say, you know, I don't necessarily like everything Mike Johnson had to do, but we realize he's trying to keep the government open. And we realize that Democrats control the Senate, Democrats control the White House, so he's in a tough spot. And we also are giving him the benefit of the doubt. And so they're saying that Johnson has kind of some leverage and goodwill with them that McCarthy didn't have after a certain point.
So to what extent do you also think that Republican members up for re-election in the fall are worried that if they continue with the kind of or if they're associated with the kind of shenanigans from the far right members of, you know, continuing to cast aspersions on the Speaker, that it's going to that the American people are increasingly going to say this has been a do nothing Congress, a do nothing House. It's time to make big changes.
I mean, I do think that Republicans know that their majority is not only getting thinner, but they do have an uphill battle in November. And that's why they're so focused on turnout. That's why you see so many Republicans falling in line behind Donald Trump, hoping that if Trump's base really is enthusiastic and engaged, they'll show up not just to vote for Trump, but to vote Republicans down the ballot. This Congress has been challenging. Republicans have not had a very successful term, again, in the majority in the House. Now, again, some of that is because we are the government is divided. Again, Democrats control the Senate, Democrats control the White House. But there's not a lot to show for this new Republican majority in the House. And again, so many of their members have not only said they're not running for another term this November, but they've left midterm, including Kevin McCarthy himself. And that's made it even worse for them.
All right. Thank you for all of that. Let's turn to a story that's a big national story. But I want to bring it back to Georgia because Governor Kemp has a stake in this as well. And I'm talking now, excuse me, about a very confusing kind of rapid fire back and forth of court decisions involving Texas Governor Greg Abbott's law, which gives state and local law enforcement officers the power to arrest and the courts to take to trial people who are in the country without documentation. Governor Kemp has been a big supporter of Governor Abbott's in all of this. He's gone down to the border. He's visited parts of the border that the state has taken control of because they're on private property. But so let's talk just briefly, And as quickly as I can, you know, summarize it, this law was put on hold as the Biden administration challenged it. The Biden administration's contention is that immigration is a matter for federal control and that a state cannot be in violation of the Supremacy Act, which says the feds have control over certain aspects of government. That was the, so the law was put on hold temporarily. The Supreme Court looked at that hold, and yesterday, in a decision that immigration, pro-immigration people were very angry about, said, no, the law can temporarily go into effect. Right?
Right.
Texas can begin this process of arresting and holding people they suspect of being undocumented. And then last night, the appeals court said, no, we're going to put it on hold again because we're going to take it up. And today, they are, the appeals court is hearing the case again. It's very confusing, but the upshot is, should a state be allowed to have the authority to deal with a federal matter of immigration?
Right. And it's, you know, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been at odds with the Biden administration. I think it'll be interesting to see how this law is treated, how this law would be treated, how in the future this law might be treated if the White House is occupied by a Republican. Because quite frankly, yes, there are unique challenges under President Biden, but the border has been a challenge for every American president. But yes, under the Biden administration, Abbott has repeatedly accused the federal government of not doing enough to enforce laws at the border to keep undocumented immigrants from entering the nation. And so now he's basically passed a law to empower state authorities to enforce immigration laws.
Tia, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you, but we have some breaking news. Okay. By the way, you just explained that really well, and I'm glad for you doing that. But here's a story that Tamar Hallerman, Dave Wickard, and Bill Rankin just reported on. Judge Scott McAfee has granted permission for former President Donald Trump and seven other defendants to appeal the McAfee decision immediately to a higher court, the decision that McAfee made to allow Fani Willis to remain as the prosecutor of this case. There was some question as to whether this would be a pre-trial or a post-trial appeal. McAfee says certification to go ahead now, which Tia suggests another delay in the prosecution of Donald Trump and other defendants here.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no way around it because now we know that they would like to appeal and that they've asked for permission to appeal. And you've got to now wait for it to go through the appeals court. And quite frankly, if they don't get the answer they want there, they can try to appeal even higher than that. I am kind of not surprised, though, because I think that Judge McAfee, I would assume that he would say, hey, if you think I got it wrong, I'm not going to stop you from asking someone else to give you a second opinion. And I think I could imagine him doing that again to thwart any criticism of his credibility or criticism of his handling of the case and to add more, you know, transparency to say, you know, I'm so confident in what I did. Yeah, go ahead, appeal it if you would like. But it doesn't help with the timeline.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that a few minutes ago we're talking about a Supreme Court decision on immigration. We're talking about a federal appeals court, a Fifth District Court dealing with immigration. Now we turn to what's happening in McAfee's court. It's just kind of astonishing, Tia, how much of our political life is now engaged in the courts in various jurisdictions around the country.
Yeah. All around the country, there are courts that are, you know, having a Trump case. And that's spreading former president pretty thin.
That's all the time we have for today's podcast. You can now hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta. Or you can do what you're doing right now. Follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app. You'll hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.